The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. I welcome you to my Saturday afternoon program on this very auspicious day. Yes, April 20th, 2013 marks the 124th birthday of one of the greatest figures in world history. This figure, I don't need to tell you, is Adolf Hitler, someone who is highly admired by many, even to the point of idolization, and hated by many, even to the point of demonization, of the most ridiculous and obvious kind. I don't seem to have a loud enough volume. I'm going to adjust my mic and see if that helps. I maybe had it down too low. All right, this looks better. I would say that it is because of this strong feeling that Hitler arouses that he remains as well known today as he was 70 to 80 years ago, when he was a prime actor on the world stage of geopolitics and during the most destructive war in world history. I'm using a lot of superlatives, I know, but it seems to be the nature of this discussion, this topic, and there's no way around it. But today, I don't want to belabor the obvious, to go over ground that has been well covered just to make us feel good. But what I want to get across is that Adolf Hitler, it seems to me, is a very famous man. And why he is. Last Saturday on this program, I said I was going to try to have a panel discussion today, which seemed like a good idea then. And I did ask a few people, but with no success. One did not want to for perfectly good reasons, and two did not respond to the invitation, and while I was considering others and while I was waiting on these people, I started to get ideas and felt that I would just as soon do the program by myself so that I could put across my ideas rather than, you know, feature other people not knowing what their ideas might be and might not be as interesting as I think my ideas are. So there we go. Here I am again on my own and feeling pretty good about it. I think that guests are more popular with listeners, and listeners look forward to hearing what you know, if you have another person on your program, and they also, I think, enjoy the back and forth between two people. But, you know, and I used to try real hard to satisfy that. But I find often now, although I like all of my guests that I have, I'm not trying to put down guests at all, but I find more often today that sometimes I just want to do the program myself, and I remind myself that it's my program and I can do it however I want to do it. It doesn't belong to other people. So, but I hope that this will turn out to be something that you all enjoy. And I hope that while I appreciate those of you who have tuned in live, I hope that there will be more, because I think this today, being the anniversary of Hitler's death, would be the time to listen to what's being said and think about it rather than later on. But most people do download the program. Okay. excuse me. I would like to get some phone calls in the second hour. I'm in the mood to interact with listeners. I do have enough material to carry me through, as I usually do, but I would enjoy if people call in, but don't call until after the break. And the number to call is 1-830-443-4911. And if you have some strong feelings about this day, about Adolf Hitler and whether we should celebrate his birthday or not, things like that, feel free to call, and I will take your call. And you can also send an email to carolyn@carolynyeager.net, and I will try very hard to remember to look at it during the break. Look at the email. So, to begin, oh, I just got a big jump in listeners. That's nice. See, you just ask and then you receive. How do I know that Hitler is the most famous man in the world? Well, I did some research and found out. And everyone everywhere knows Adolf Hitler, and most people do admire him. If you live in the West, you might not think that that is true. But if you think about all around the world, most people all around the world outside of the West that's been so highly propagandized by the leadership that's in control of all Western countries today, they don't get all this demonization of Adolf Hitler, and they start forming opinions based on whatever they see and know. And of course, a big part of it is looking up information on the internet, which I'll get to momentarily. And so I would say probably if you took the whole world's population, more people admire Hitler than despise him. But one thing that I looked at was a poll that was taken. Now, it's true, this is last year. Almost thought it was 2006. 2012, in June of 2012. There was a poll taken by somebody there in the UK, and they found that Hitler's face was the most recognizable of all the faces that they showed I think it might have been school kids, or it might have been everybody. I don't have that information right now. But they found that the Hitler's face was correctly identified by 944 out of 1,000 people. And he was the number one. Nobody else was recognized the way that he was. And that's pretty good. 944 people out of 1,000. In today's world where people are so, you know, if these were students, I think this might have been school kids. They said that in spite of the fact that 20 British children thought he was a German football coach, they still knew who he was. They still knew his name, but they're a little confused about 1 in 20, only 1 in 20. That's not bad. That's not bad. Only 1 in 20 thought that. See, they say things like that in order to take away from the reality that Adolf Hitler is so well known. And that's something that I'm going to point out here that they can't get away from. I think that a lot of this demonization and even the Holocaust was invented in order to have something to attack Hitler on, to try to destroy and discourage his popularity, because they knew already what kind of popularity was going to develop and had already existed. And they had to come up with ways. They couldn't make him, they couldn't ignore him. If they ignored him, his popularity would just keep growing and growing. So they had to demonize him. And they have been coming up with whatever they can to do that. And that just makes him, I guess, even more famous, because he's being talked about from both sides. And that's part of the reason. So they do contribute to his fame, but they felt they had no choice. That's just kind of a theory that I have. Now, there's another more interesting thing that I found, which was this listverse.com. They have they make lists, top 10 lists of all kinds of things. And there was one in March, just last month, 2013. They decided to do the top 10 most famous people, top 10 most famous people of all the world. And they did it by using Google searches and the number of books that have been written about these people. And they ended up with Hitler at number 7, but actually Hitler is really at number 1, and I'll tell you why. They judged Jesus Christ at number 1, and the amount of Google searches were 24.9 million per month. Every month, 24.9 million Google searches on Jesus Christ, which, you know, I believe, but they didn't list any books about him. But, you know, there's probably just zillions. So he's number one. Well, that's all right, except the point that I'm trying to make, going to make here, is that all these ones that come in before Hitler are all religious figures. They're all founder, you know, they may not have founded the religion, but somebody founded it in their name. And so, and they all go back, way back, at least 2,000 years, over 2,000 years. Whereas Adolf Hitler only goes back 100, actually he died in 68 years ago. So, you know, there's a total disconnect here with comparing him with these other people. So I'll just tell you that Jesus Christ is number one and has way more Google searches than number two, which is Muhammad. And he has a longer name than that, but I'm just using Muhammad. We know who that is, the God or the founder of Islam. Google searches 13.6 million per month. That's quite a lot less than Jesus Christ. I have to point that out. They don't talk about books about him either. But Abraham, I guess because the Google searches are so far ahead, the number three is Abraham, a totally kind of fictitious character, who's Google, but that's all right. You can guess you can be a fictitious character. But Google searches 9.1 million per month, way down, quite a bit down from the other two. And the number of books they estimate that are about, that have Abraham in them are 2 million. So that puts him number three. Then number four is Moses. Google searches 2.7 million per month. Quite a bit less than Abraham. Isn't that funny? Abraham 9.1 million, Moses 2.7 million per month. And they estimate about 8 million books contain, you know, are about Moses in one way or another. Well, you know, you're going to find Moses in tons of things. You know, again, we're talking about these old religious figures. This is another mythical figure. And then we have Buddha. He's only number five. He comes in behind all these Jewish characters in Christian, Islam, then two Jewish characters, although the Christian identity people are going to scream at me about for saying that. Sorry about that, folks. And then Buddha, who has a name, Gautama the Buddha. 4 million Google searches per month. Now, that's more than Moses. But they put him after Moses because they only say that there's 7 million books written about Buddha, where there's 8 million books written about Moses. Well, I think that the Google searches is a far better indicator of popularity than how they can try to figure out how many books he's in. So I think that's something wrong there. You know, who's messing with this list, maybe, to put Moses up there higher so he doesn't look bad. And then after Buddha, we have Paul of Tarsus, which they say is number six with 3.35 million Google searches per month. And a number of books, 7 million. Well, this puts him, you know, ahead of Moses in Google searches and equal to Buddha in books. So I don't think that's quite, you know, I don't know how they figure that to do that, but it's not too important. So then finally comes Adolf Hitler, number seven. And he has 6.1 million Google searches per month. Now that is more than Paul of Tarsus, more than Buddha, and way more than Moses. It only comes under Abraham at 9 million. And then you have Hitler at 6 million. So right there he should be number three. Although the reason they don't is because they estimate the number of books about Hitler are 175,000. Well, you know, I try to find that number because I've heard that there are a million books about Adolf Hitler, over a million. I've read things like that. Well, I couldn't find that anywhere. And Amazon doesn't tell you. And no, well, I mean, I'm not the best. I don't know much about super advanced searches and so on. I know where I should have gone, which I didn't, I never think about the cat. The, you know, that catalog of books, worldwide Universal. I should have gone there. But you'd think they would have gone there. And that maybe, you know, they came up with something like that. Well, I don't know that there's 175,000 books is a lot. But let's look at it this way, too. Again, what I said earlier, Adolf Hitler was born 124 years ago. And he died 68 years ago. So all these books wouldn't have been written, so many, you know, most of them afterwards. So that's a short period of time, whereas you have these other characters, and I will call them characters, except for Jesus Christ, who go way back. And so you've had all these, well, Jesus Christ over 2,000 years, Muhammad, what? I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know the exact timing of him. He's around that time, but let's say 2,000 or less than 2,000, 1,800 or something, I don't know, years ago. So they've had all this time to be in all these books, whereas Hitler is new. So I would say that, you know, considering all the things that I've said, Hitler is actually number one. He's number one because he's a real historical person, and he's not the leader of a religion or somebody who, you know, is in all these books that are written about religion or a religion, and then historians too. But these other people, they're kind of lost. Their real life is lost in time and mythology. We don't know much about their real life. We read things, maybe more about Muhammad's real life. I don't know how accurate they all are. I don't read about it much. I've just read very, very, very slightly about this person. But, you know, they're just in a different classification than Hitler. So if you would compare, so here you have Hitler coming in number seven after all these big, big religious figures and religion founders and so on. So that's really amazing that they found that. And so I would say basically, you know, that Google searches is probably the best indicator and of today of the interest. And so according to their Google searches, Jesus Christ is three times as many as Adolf Hitler. Well, good for him. And Muhammad is a little over twice. So, well, there's a lot of Muslims in the world. So it's understandable. Actually, Buddha is less. So there's a lot of Buddhists, aren't there? But maybe they're not into this kind of thing as much. Google searches and so on. And we don't find any Hindus or anything like that. But here we have Adolf Hitler, 6.1 million Google searches per month. That's only on Google. People search on other search engines too, but then they do for the others also. So this was just quite a revelation to me. I thought it was worth really looking into. And considering the short period of time that Adolf Hitler has been, a factor in the world, you know, that he has been a living being in the world under that name. And it's just quite amazing. So now I found another interest. Oh, was it this one? No, let me see. What is this one? There was more of them. All right. After Hitler, number seven, here's the people who came who followed Hitler. Shakespeare was next at number eight. Leonardo da Vinci, number nine. And Sir Isaac Newton, number 10. That's as far as they went. So after Hitler came these three geniuses. Shakespeare, who's, you know, very, very well known, and Leonardo da Vinci and Sir Isaac Newton. But I don't remember, you know, I didn't write down the number of Google searches, but I think it was quite a bit less, although they were pretty high. So a lot of people are looking up those, probably kids from school, too, do a lot of that. But there were no politicians or political leaders and no Jews. There's no Jews in this list except these old Abraham and Moses, which, again, the Christian identity tell me they're not. So they're going to tell me Paul of Tarsus isn't either. So therefore, but you know, it's just the excuse me, the what we think of as Jews, you know, the Jews, the people that the Jews put up as, you know, their great Sigmund Freud or something like that, you know. Nah, he wouldn't come in anywhere close. So, and of course, no Churchill, no Stalin, no Roosevelt, God forbid. They're not nearly as popular as Adolf Hitler. So you can't, about this number of books about Hitler, I couldn't find, as I told you, I couldn't find anything about that. So I think that pretty well sums up the idea that Adolf Hitler is in the running for the most famous man in the world and the most famous historical figure, perhaps, who has ever lived. And his popularity is not going down. A few other things I found that show where Hitler comes in first is, you know, the Columbine shooting occurred on April 20th in 2001, I think it was. But every year when April 20th rolls around, the talk is about Hitler's birthday before people talk about Columbine, usually. And this is another indication that Hitler outranks everybody. I found a number of places where they listed the things that had taken place in what they call the bad events that took place in April. And they started out with Hitler's birthday. And then came Columbine shooting. And then another thing is that Lenin's birthday is April 22nd. And does anybody ever mention that? Does anybody care when Lenin's birthday is? No. And, you know, it's 2 days after Hitler's. 2 days after, but you never hear about that. Well, I don't. I suppose in some circles you would, but they're not very wide circles. So, now, another thing I found rather astonishing was that Wikipedia has an entire entry on Hitler's 50th birthday. Now, one thing I failed to do, sorry, just thought of it now, was to look and see how many Wikipedia pages there were regarding Hitler. Of course, there's a lot. There's, you know, Hitler himself, then there's the party, then the rise of Hitler, and probably the death of Hitler, and the this of Hitler, and that, and then there's all these events that took place, that, you know, he was under his command and so on, and all these battles and so on, and, where he maybe played a larger role, but they have this entire entry that I did see, that was just on Hitler's 50th birthday. Because, of course, you know, we all like next year, it will be Hitler's 125th birthday. So that'll be more important, more attention will be paid to it because it's one of those round numbers. You go from 25, 50, 75, and 100, and people are, you know, consider those major anniversaries. So his 50th birthday naturally was a major anniversary, and it was quite a lot of events going on. You know, it wasn't Hitler who wanted all this to be done. It was the people around him, and they knew that the people in the nation, the German people, wanted to celebrate his birthdays, and he got huge numbers of gifts that he couldn't possibly use, and, you know, a lot of them were food that people made special things that they specialized in and sent them. And, you know, they made every effort to take these things to homes and, you know, wherever they could use them, you know, wherever this could be used. So they didn't let it go to waste. But, this 50th birthday was such a big deal that, they have this special Wikipedia page just for that. I'm sorry, I'm having a little rough throat. Take a little water here and cough for a minute. Hold on. Whoops. I meant to turn my mic down and I turned it up. Sorry about that. Now, I checked, I found some interesting things on Stormfront. They've got a Hitler's birthday thread. And I hadn't looked at it, but finally I looked at it this morning and found some interesting things. And one fellow, Well, somebody posted, there's about four or five pages, five or six pages or more of it. Somebody posted that Hitler is the central figure in Western world history and the greatest leader the modern Western world has ever seen, and happy birthday. And this one fellow on there seemed to be about the only one. He made two posts he's not happy about celebrating Hitler's birthday. And he had said something earlier that, that he thought it was kind of ridiculous, to be celebrating somebody's 120, you know, a dead person's birthday. We don't do that for others. Well, here's where he says it. He says that's opinion based, what this guy was saying. He says fact based is we don't go around saying happy birthday, Benjamin Franklin or John Adams or George Washington. It's bizarre, he says. Well, you know, I'm just kind of amazed at this, that people think that Benjamin Franklin or John Adams or George Washington are equal to Adolf Hitler in the impression, at least on the world. George Washington is certainly famous. He's the father of this country and so on, but he's not that well known outside of the United States. I mean, he's not thought about that much. He's pretty much American. While I admire George Washington, although some people don't, I cannot think that you, I think it's bizarre to compare these men to Hitler, that this person is lacking an understanding of I guess if you found the Google searches for George Washington every month, it would be way, way, way lower. So that just kind of tells you what people are really interested in. But he wants people to think differently than they do is what he wants. Well, that's okay, because I want people to think differently than they do also. We all do that. Now, another storm fronter that gave a very good summing up, I thought, and I'm being real pro-Hitler here, but he said 124 years from the birth of the greatest man ever to live, the man who understood the natural laws and created an ideology, a system far superior and better for the people than the democratic and communist ones. Well, I thought that was well put, because that's how I see it. I see it more and more that Hitler understood things that most people have not understood. And he understood the natural laws, and he created an ideology or we call it the Weltanschauung, a worldview, an entire whole point of view from which to look at, view the world, and that was very superior. And while it is said that all these ideas already existed, sure, there's a lot of ideas that exist and people put them forth, but nobody was able to put it across and pull it together the way Adolf Hitler did. And so he was the man, he was the man of destiny, and I'll go into that a little bit more after I finish this, these comments. So another, let's see, this is the same one. He goes on to say, this is quite an achievement, and no surprise that so many people, here's another part of what he said that was good, no surprise that so many people changed their opinion after they got themselves familiar with his writings and National Socialism on their own, and not by listening to the propaganda and lies from their teachers, from the movies and the thousands of anti-Hitler books. Well, I think, again, that is so correct. The more that people find out about Adolf Hitler on their own and read his writings and not get away from all the stuff, even if they've been totally educated up to the point by the popular demonization, which I was and everybody has been, except for a few people who are still alive who lived during that time and knew it firsthand. But they, you know, once you do that, you start changing your mind. That's part of this Mein Kampf controversy that's going on, that the copyright of the state of Bavaria is running out. What is it? The end of this year or something? And now they're trying to decide, you know, if it just goes on sale, for people to buy and so on, how many people are going to be, you know, positively affected by it. So they want to come out with these annotated versions and only these annotated versions and somehow control it so that people will buy these where they put in their propaganda in the book, like some of these Bibles, like the Scofield Bible, where they just twist everything around. And you know who's behind that. But anyway, it's a real quandary because when people look at Hitler and read Hitler and see his speeches and see plenty about him, they start changing their mind about him and it becomes far more positive. So another good comment on Stormfront is from Alphonse Heck. It's not from Alphonse Heck. It's somebody, a poster who is quoting Alphonse Heck. And he says this: Alphonse Heck, a former member of the Hitler Youth, describes the reaction to a speech by Hitler. Quote, "We erupted into a frenzy of nationalistic pride that bordered on hysteria. For minutes on end, we shouted at the top of our lungs, with tears streaming down our faces, 'Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil! Sieg Heil!' From that moment on, I belonged to Adolf Hitler, body and soul." Well, that's a quote from this Alphonse Heck. And this was common. I mean, this, when you were in person, when you heard Hitler speak, people were so taken by storm by it. We have to get into what this says about Hitler. But, those who heard him speak and felt fear about it and wanted to fight against him, it was because they recognized the power and the truth that was there in this very, very unique human being. And they had to, set up barriers against it. But those who did not see it that way were totally taken by it. And you wonder why the German people, who he was speaking to as his fellow, his fellow national people, were so overwhelmingly in support of him because they saw him, they heard him. You know, I recall as a teenager, especially, I think this was when it was, and later too, but, you know, then it made an impression on me. I recall this one particular article in a magazine that we had that came, you know, in my home, my parents' home, and it had an article in it about Adolf Hitler and trying to make it out that he was, that he had mesmerized the people of Germany. And there was a picture of him with his, you know, giving a speech at night in one of those night rallies and, you know, trying to make him look like a real demagogue and so on. And then there was a picture of some people standing in the audience. So they were standing in this big rally ground. And one woman, they focused in on one woman, and she had this rapt look on her face, you know, R-A-P-T, rapt. She was just like transported. And that was supposed to show how he was, controlling these people's minds, you know, with his crazy talk and his nationalistic frenzy and so on. And he was getting these people carried away into things that normally good Germans wouldn't do. But because of that, they did all these awful things. And there was an example of it. Well, you know, I can see now that people did feel that way when Hitler spoke. And it was a combination of the power of this man and also of the fact that the Germans knew, they all knew what had been done to them in World War II, even before World War II and during World War II, and what kind of a dirty deal they had been given. I mean, one of the dirtiest deals in history up to that time. And they were suffering from 1918 onward with this dirty deal. And they all resented it, and I mean deeply, and they knew. And when Hitler came along and spoke, and I don't know what year this was, that this magazine, it was probably something from, you know, not the very beginning of his political career, but sometime maybe even after he was chancellor. But they saw what he was doing for them. And went, and so they were, you know, won over more and more. And when he spoke, I mean, they were just carried along in it. Now, how many people in history had the effect on an audience that Adolf Hitler had? And again, we're speaking to an audience of his own people. His own people. He's not, you know, this is not, he's not over there, causing the Japanese to, he didn't go to Japan and give speeches to stir up the Japanese to be good, you know, good, allies with him. He was only always talking to his own people. And they knew that, and they sensed it, definitely. And, so what my question here is, you know, what kind of a person is he? Well, was he? I think, I don't like to go into turning him into, a cult figure or somebody, you know, I don't like using the word avatar or that some people do. I understand why they do, but I think it's too early for one thing. Again, I want to emphasize that Hitler, has only been dead for 68 years. He's only been gone physically from us for 68 years. That's not a long time. It might seem a long time to people who are, younger. Than a lot younger than me, I can understand that. But for me, it's not a long time, and of course, it isn't. It's not even a whole lifetime of a person who lives a decent, you know, length of life. So, you know, he's very much a man. But what kind of a man? He was a man who had gifts that not only were especially elevated, you know, of a high, high nature, but he also had them in a combination that was, that allowed him to be a kind of a savior to not only his own people, but in a large way, to the Western world and Western peoples. And even to other peoples all around the world now who look to what he did and say, well, you know, that's how we feel in our nation too. And this is what we want. And, he had a strength about him. He had a will. He had the ability to exercise his will, but he also practiced this. I mean, I don't know if you call it practice, but he also, worked at it. He worked at disciplining himself so that he could not be got at, you know, so that he would not weaken. Because he saw the weakening as the worst, as the failing that would do in his program and what he wanted to accomplish. Because it was in World War I, it was the weakening of the German people in their resolve to continue fighting, and this was done through ill means. You know, this was done back home. This was done I'm at a loss here. This was done through the stab in the back. We really fall to that, but you know, through ill people wishing ill will, and this was done through rumor and innuendo and so on, and weakening the resolve of people. And he knew that the most important thing was to never let your resolve weaken once you have determined on your resolve. And this was something that he and he alone seemed to be able to do, as one looks at the very end of his regime and his, right before his death by suicide, was that, so many people didn't keep that resolve. And, this was a great disappointment, but this one person who did keep it was himself. And that is one of the things that he's been so criticized for. He's been very much criticized for not giving up sooner, for carrying this on so long, for continuing to hold on when there was no hope, etc., etc. But that was his whole character. And that is why I think a large part of why he can still be held in the high esteem he is today, and why he still means so much to us, and why he's a symbol of that. And it's turning out to be very important. Hitler often said, I've gone totally off my notes here, I'm just going on and on here, but Hitler often said that said that Providence was in charge of everything, and he would, the one thing that he bowed his head to, the one thing that he deferred to, was what he called Providence, and that was in his vocabulary what would be God in many others, but he used Providence, I think, because he didn't want to convey the idea of this personal God who has personal choices and likes and this and that, you know, makes personal decisions about events as they are happening. But that Providence is something more set, you know, and in a sense also knows the future. In some way, there is a future, it will come about in some way, but we don't know the way it will happen. And so when he was facing defeat, he did bow, in my estimation, to Providence and say that this is what is happening, but he still knew he was right, and that we would see what would, you know, how it would come about, how things would evolve in the future, according to the will of Providence. So he always was humble enough to say that he was playing his role, that he wasn't the master of affairs and the master of what would happen. He was only playing his role in that humble way that one is in the face of one's God, which this was for him. So I'll get back to my notes here. Going on to some more of the news that I was looking for news about Hitler's birthday. And I found, of course, I knew this. There was this thing at NPR. NPR came out. This one got a lot of sort of controversy. This one correspondent of theirs, Dina Temple Raston, was talking about the Boston bombings. And, of course, you know, that's the big topic right now. But I think on this day, I can leave that aside and let other people talk about that. And while I talk about Hitler's birthday. But she was talking about the Boston bombings and made the comment, April is a big month for anti-government and right-wing individuals. There's the Columbine anniversary. There's Hitler's birthday. There's the Oklahoma City bombing, the assault on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco. And they were, you know, there's been a lot of criticism from mostly whites about how not just NPR, but a lot of these news media were characterizing the Boston Marathon bombing up until these two guys were caught, who are the alleged perpetrators. I don't have any faith in anything that the mainstream media comes up with. But now here's a case where she mentioned Columbine before Hitler's birthday. But in most cases I found, Hitler's birthday was mentioned first. But one thing that I could point out here is that they've got four events here, and three of them are purely in the United States of America. You know, Columbine, Oklahoma City, Waco. And then the fourth one is not the United States of America at all. It's something that really should not have anything to do with this country in a sense, and not much anymore. And that's Hitler's birthday. So that's just, again, another example of how big Hitler is, how big he is. And they know that, you know, in Germany, birthdays are always celebrated. And, of course, Hitler's birthday was always highly celebrated. And so they, you know, they hate that, that on this day, people still bring up all their positive feelings about Adolf Hitler. And so the Hitler's birthday is plays a big role in their terrible happenings. You know, it's compared to the Oklahoma City bombing and the Columbine shootings and so on. Can you, I mean, it's just amazing how this thinking goes. All right. Another little item is that, now this is from last year, but it's just kind of humorous. It won't take very long to tell. In the, in Britain, in the UK, they had a story, that last year, around Hitler's birthday, they came out with that, the current director of the Deutsche Oper, the German opera house in Berlin, the largest one in Berlin, was in a scandal suddenly because earlier in the year they were planning a premiere of a Wagnerian opera, Rienzi, which was supposedly or had been said by Hitler to be his favorite Wagner opera, and the director had just was making the schedule, and he had it penciled in as the premiere happening on April 20th, and didn't even cross his mind, you know, what that date was, but it says that he was notified by his staff that he needed to revise his plans, and they were complaining about it. And of course he did. And so they changed it so that Rienzi would premiere on the following day, April 21st, instead of April 20th, as though that's going to make a big difference. But that's what they had to do. Because I guess once you get a production schedule, you can't just change it around that much. So they put it off one day, and you know, it makes for a big story. It was probably in the German press too, and I didn't notice it or don't remember that if I did. But you know, it was just like, oh my God, we can't premiere Hitler's favorite Wagner opera on his birthday. It would appear that, you know, we're doing it to celebrate his birthday in honor of him or something. But they only moved it one day, but that was enough. I have got a speech of Hitler, not of Hitler's, a speech about Hitler's birthday, which was, I don't know if it was ever given. It says it's an outline for a speech, and it can be found at Calvin, www.calvin.edu, in the German propaganda archives, which, and it's from 1942. So that's was Adolf Hitler, 1942. Either it was given or it was, he wrote it. It was written by Kurt Eggers. And this Kurt Eggers, I'd heard of him, but I never really learned too much about him before. But he was a great man in his own right. I'm gonna read you his biography here before I read the speech that he wrote for 1942 for Hitler's birthday. And, it says that he was both a scholar. Well, I say that he was both a scholar and a warrior, and the best and the highest kind of a German person. And he was born in 1905 in 1917, which means at 12 years of age, he entered the cadet corps and began training on a school ship. In 1919, 2 years later, age of 14, he witnessed the defeat of the Spartacist uprising. Now, that was after, you know, following World War I defeat. And in 1921, he's now only 16, he joined the Freikorps and was involved in the battle for Annaberg Hill, which is where the German Freikorps personnel fought against Polish nationalists for this piece of property, which they valued very highly. Both sides wanted it. The Germans got it, but later, of course, they lost it again. This Kurt Eggers, then, after being in the Freikorps, He resumed his education in 1924 at age 19. He studied Sanskrit, archaeology, philosophy, and theology in Rostock, Berlin, and Göttingen. He was particularly interested in the German Reformation and the revolutionary Ulrich von Hutten. You'd have to look him up. I looked him up, but I'm not going to say anything about him. Von Hutten, V-O-N, and then H-U-T-T-E-N. He joined the Corps Vandalia Rostock, a student group, in 1927 at age 22. And after his theology exams, he became a pastor in Neustrelitz, and then a curate in Berlin. However, he rapidly fell out with church authorities because of his Song of the Struggling Peasants. That has to be a poem that he wrote. And this call, a song or poem, called for violent revolt against the government and church, I suppose. And after that, he broke with Christianity. And so then with the rise of power of Adolf Hitler, this would have been in 33, I think, he received rapid promotion through the new regime, gaining a succession of party positions while he continued to work as a writer, producing plays, radio drama, musical comedies, folk stories, walking songs, martial songs, and chants. In other words, this tells me he was highly productive, and he was also highly talented. His verse was widely used in Nazi ceremonies and events. Following the invasion of Poland, 1939, he headed for the front, joining the staff of a panzer company, but he later returned to writing as editor-in-chief of the SS's newspaper, Das Schwarze Korps, the Black Corps, they wore those black uniforms, and as a war correspondent. So that's what he did then, and then in mid-1942, he was working as a writer for the party chancellery, and he expressed a desire to return to battle. He was transferred to the Panzer Reserve. From there, he joined the 5th SS Panzer Division Viking, which was made up largely of foreign volunteers, and he became involved in their withdrawal from the Caucasus in the winter of 42-43. In late July 1943, he rejoined the Viking Division, and the German Kursk offensive was grinding to a halt. That was a terrible battle. And the Russians were driving the Germans back. On August 12th, 1943, he died southwest of Belgorod, which is now in western Russia near the border with Ukraine, while attempting to counterattack against the advancing Russians. His death was marked by a memorial service on September 26, 1943, in the Kroll Opera House in Berlin. I assume that it was an official Third Reich memorial service for this man. It says the SS War Reporters section, a platoon of war correspondents attached to SS units, was renamed the SS Standarte Kurt Eggers in a ceremony in November 1943. So the Hitler regime had a high opinion of this man. And after reading his speech, this one speech that he wrote, and learning about him, I do too. He also had 4 children by his second wife, whose father was a pastor. Okay, so on top of all that, he managed to have 4 children with a good German woman. So there you go. There's somebody that is someone to really look up to. I don't have too much time here. I've got a few minutes. I'm going to be reading this speech for you, and I think it's well worth it. I'll have some comments as I read. It's called The Führer's Birthday, and let's see if there's anything I want to say before I start this when I come back. Well, I'll just say that there's more I've got here from Calvin EDU. You know, this Calvin EDU is written by a man who was looking for a different kind of profession, but someone who was in the propaganda field at a university when he was applying for something else, wanted someone to study under him, government or German propaganda or something. And so he accepted that, and he already knew German, I guess, and he got into that and became very, very fascinated with it. Now, this is, I'm talking about somebody, I haven't even named him. And I don't have his name written here, but I should remember it, although I'm not remembering it. I will look it up during the break, and I'll also check my email. I'll check my email right now, and also remind you that you can call in during the break. I mean, after the break, if you want. I would love to hear from you. I would love to hear from anybody who wants to call in after the break. And then, but at this Bitwork is his name, who put up this Calvin EDU. I guess that's the university he's associated with. And it's full of wonderful stuff. German propaganda. I mean, if we didn't know better, we would think that he was working on our side. And sometimes I wonder if he is. But he says that he's not. And he says that he's against the kind of system, the National Socialist system and so on. He's a big proponent of democracy. But he's put up all this wonderful material. And so I often go there to see, you know, what I can use. And I've also got some words of the Führer that I can go into, and some quotes from Hitler that are really good, and some other things, and then some stuff I'd like to say about Horst Mahler. But I just soon talk to you and talk about that another time. So we'll see how it goes. We'll be back in 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh,
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager. I'm checking the sound level. Okay, on Saturday afternoon. And today is April 20th, 2013, which is Adolf Hitler's birthday. His 124th birthday, to be exact. And his death was 68 years ago today. No, his death wasn't today. Sorry about that. 68 years ago, anyway. Now, I was telling you about Calvin EDU, and the man's name who's responsible for that great website is Randall. It's about German propaganda archive, is Randall Bitwerk. And that's spelled, I think, B-Y-T-W-E-R-K. And let me remind you that the telephone call-in number is 1-830-443-4911 if you have something that you'd like to say on the program. Keep it to the topic, please, if you do call in. Now, let me check one more time the mail. And I'm going to read something that I think is, well, here's somebody sending an email. A little tidbit of information from a regular listener to my programs, who always listens live, it seems, from The Beasts of the Apocalypse by Oliver Marie O'Grady's book. He says, page 157, the longer Mohammed studied the Jews, the more he became convinced of the irreconcilable differences between their religious systems and his own. Mohammed made Abraham an Arab when he got around to the Quran. Well, great. He attacked the customs and belief of the Jews and accused them of misinterpreting and concealing the true meaning of the scripture. The Jews, asserted Muhammad, are asses who carry books. Okay, he's got a lot more here, but I'm not going to read all that. Thank you. Thank you very much, Stuart, for that. And I'll go back here and go back here. Okay. Now, to start this second hour off, this is called the Führer's Birthday. And it's written by Kurt Eggers, who I told you about earlier. And it is called an outline for a speech. Obedient historians have often enough dignified emperors and kings, nobles and the powerful, with the flattering term, the great. Without, however, ensuring that these fine men actually went down in that way in the book of world history. In reality, the great men of history are rare. There are even whole centuries that lack a towering historic figure. The historically great are those few personalities who stamp a whole epoch with their will, which lives on into the future, excuse me, and entirely changes the political order. Great men are also rare because the unity of idea and will, of desire and action, is so seldom achieved. As we celebrate today the birthday of our Führer and bow before the greatness of this man, remember this was 1942, we have both the right and duty as people who think politically, beyond all cheap outward enthusiasm, to ask what is behind this greatness. Deceived by liberal superficiality during the bourgeois era, people said that character was molded by the environment. The Führer refutes this persuasively. He worked hard to build his will and knowledge such that he became one of the deepest experts not only on the German nature, but on the deep political connections of world politics. This, you know, there's so many things in this speech that show that this Kurt Eggers was himself a man who had tremendous insight and wisdom and special kind of brains when he points out that Hitler was an expert on the German nature. And, you know, that is what makes Germans tick. What are Germans like? I think that is so true. That is one of the big secrets or the big reasons for why he was able to accomplish so much with the Germans. And it wasn't cynical. It wasn't like the Jews do. Well, I'm going to figure out what these Germans are like and then I'll play, you know, wind them up and make them do what I want. No, he did it out of love of the Germans, and wanting to have something that would be just right for them, just right for Germans in Germany. So I thought that was an amazing sentence. He goes on, the Führer's ruthless self-discipline gave him the strength of his convictions and the unshakable confidence of a genius who reaches his goals through the full force of his will. The Führer has never been given anything, nor has he allowed himself to be given anything. All that he has, both intellectually and spiritually, he won himself. The blows of fate that he suffered from his youngest days onward made him harder and more passionate. He thus developed a character not dependent on a more or less hostile environment, but rather one able to stand against any opposition. So he's saying here that he wasn't dependent on whether the environment was more or less hostile. You know, it didn't make any difference. Whatever it was, he would stand against any opposition to his goals. The World War was the last test of his character. With pride, the Führer has always said that he learned as a simple soldier to bear the full weight of war. The war did not break him, but rather enabled him to understand more clearly and plainly the reality of life. As chaos fell over Germany after 1918, the wisdom of those philosophers and poets who proclaimed that only character can survive defeat and collapse was proven. In the familiar words of the Greek writer of tragedy, there is much that is powerful, but nothing that is more powerful than man. His words find amazing proof in the Führer, that is the words of the Greek writer. A single man with one goal who applied his passionate will in a time that lacked will, a single man proclaimed his freedom during the years of slavery. Coming ages will see the Führer as an almost mythic figure who did not only stand against the flow of a worthless era, but rather against a whole avalanche of apparently irresistible fate. He stood up as Germany was in danger of vanishing into the mists of history, changing history's very direction. We remember the catastrophic years that began in 1919. We remember the disgrace of Versailles, Germany's enslavement, terrible arbitrary international forces. While well-meaning bourgeois circles at best were dreaming that one day freedom would once more shine on Germany, the Führer pondered and labored to realize his idea of freedom, which had as its presupposition the mobilization of the German soul. Year in, year out, first unnoticed, then piled high with suspicion, envy, and ridicule, the Führer wandered through Germany and woke the best of the nation, leading them to self-awareness, forcing them under his prophetic will. The National Socialist movement developed as a gathering of those Germans who no longer wanted something for themselves, but rather thought only of Germany and of the eternal life of the nation. When the seizure of power came in 1933, bourgeois politicians probably thought that the Führer had achieved the goal of his struggle. Those who saw, or at least sensed more deeply, realized that it was only the starting point for the second and most difficult phase of the Führer's great struggle. Well, now, before I go on to the second part of this speech, again, reminding you that this was in April 1942, and at that, I've read that Hitler was supposedly at his greatest height of power in 1942, early 1942, mid 1942 maybe. And so things were looking, even though they are in this tremendous struggle now in Russia, it was all still looking good there and looking positive. So Eggers goes on. I need some water. History teaches that great revolutionary brilliant ideas always encounter the fierce hatred of the world, and that no one has come to lead a nation who is not threatened with war by all the old forces. Well, certainly in Germany, in Europe, that was true. And if you're in the center of Europe surrounded by other nations, that was even more true, that you're going to be threatened with war when you come to be a strong leader. With enormous determination and clear knowledge of the way things were, the Führer proceeded to rearm Germany and make it strong. The enemy no longer had the freedom to dream of an attack on the German people. Within a few years, he succeeded in unifying a people that had been split by states, religions, dictates, and treaties, making the German Reich the homeland of all Germans. We remember these years of construction at the triumph of a passionate will for German freedom. You know, those are very important words and very true. There was a lot of division among Germans, particularly, you know, the Catholic, Protestant, the North and the South, the different states and different ideas that they had, different histories and so on. But this had been started with Bismarck, of course, but it was still there was still a lot of work to be done that Hitler did manage to do under his own direction, under his own power of his own personality. So going back to Eggers, there were some who, seeing the gathering thunderclouds around Germany, nervously asked what fate had in store should war break out. We National Socialists who saw the Führer as a unique historic personality who took into account all conceivable possibilities were and remain full of confidence. As the enemy forces began the war, the Führer proved that he had the answer to the frequently discussed question of who should have the final say during war, the politician or the general. There was no division between politician and general. The Führer possessed both gifts. Thus, he joined the small, proud group of those men of history who are able to represent the totality of an entire nation. I wish he would give names of those he, you know, this is me again. I wish Eggers would have given names of those he thinks is in this small, proud group, because I really don't know who they are. And if I knew who he has in mind, what, Napoleon? I don't know. Then I might be able to think about it and see how Hitler compares with them, and if they compare with Hitler even. Of course, they could have had larger nations than he did, but anyway, that would be interesting to me. Continuing, we ourselves are witnesses of the victories won by no one but the Führer, and we are deeply moved to see what a people can do that is united politically and spiritually by the hand of such a man. This was not, this is me again, this was not extravagant praise, because all the reunited German people had this opinion and had this belief about Hitler that only he had done all this. And it's true. It was he who did all that. People who want to try to take away credit from Hitler and say, oh, this was done by this and this was done by so-and-so and he didn't really do this. And, that's not according to the facts. And a lot of these victories, the earlier victories, were his plans and his doing, his ideas. I will try to remember to talk about afterwards about Hitler and his generals, according to Ein Ander Hitler. Okay, I have to write a note or I'll totally forget about it. So Eggers says, we ourselves experienced the collapse of the old system. We ourselves fought in a numerically inferior army that defeated overwhelmingly superior armies. We learned that the passion of will and joyful ideas overcame walls of steel and concrete. Again, he says, the passion of will and joyful ideas overcame walls of steel and concrete. It's true, they can. Doesn't seem like it, though. Doesn't seem like they can, but they do. They do. And this war has shown us that there is nothing that can withstand ready, fearless people who are confident of the superiority of the Führer. It always goes back to the Führer, and it's not just because it's a birthday speech. Well, I mean, maybe part of it, but you know, it does in the minds of the Germans. It always did go back to him, and they did believe. I just said this, but I'm saying it again, that it was him that was responsible for all this, and that's why they would never get rid of him. They never thought that somebody else would do better. Only a few people had that idea. Certainly far, 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 for it's just a small number when you take in the whole number of German people at that time that were all reunited again. And so, you know, they had confidence in him. And that is, you can see that in all these videos, all these films we have, all this imagery and so on. You see that very clearly. So Eggers says the totality of his leadership, the uniqueness of his character, have gathered all alert people of our nation behind the flag of the Reich. We have not asked how long the war will last, nor which tasks lie before us. After each victorious battle, we have tightened our helmets and waited for the Führer's next orders. Well, that was easier to say in April 1942, but he still would have said it later. We know that the longing of generations for freedom and the Reich are becoming reality in the battle we are fighting in the Führer's name. We believe in the Reich we are building through our sacrifice, and we know that this Reich will be the home of free, honorable, upright, and strong people. We know our historic mission, building a Reich that will give old and tired Europe a new, youthful, powerful, and just order. May the Führer find in the aware and thoughtful people of his nation that absolute sacrificial and loyal obedience that is worthy of his confidence. We have learned to see life's reality not as a problem, but rather as a fighting mission. Our loyalty demands that we fulfill this mission, which binds us completely to the Führer as the agent of that law that we obey. And signed, Kurt Eggers. Well, I think that's one of the best speeches about Hitler that I've ever read. Very well written, beautiful language. And, of course, it's translated into English. I suppose Bitwork translated this. This Bitwork seems to do a very honest job. He's translated most of the stuff on his website, which is the Calvin EDU, German Propaganda Archive. But I think he's translated most of it, unless it would say otherwise. And it all seems to be very fair and well done. He is the one who I was saying on another program that he does not like the Ford translation of Mein Kampf at all. That's his newest one. And he says why. And he says that this Ford is somebody who's not qualified to do it. And what he's done is not a good, very good product. I think he's saying that honestly, truthfully. You know, that's what he really thinks. Now, let's see. Let me get to my next. All right. Words of the Führer. This is still from Calvin EDU, and this is by the Führer. This is by Adolf Hitler in Breslau in 1937. He spoke this, I suppose. And it's on the struggle of the unity and freedom of the German people. Hitler said, I entered political life with the burning desire to destroy German party life and replace it with a German people's community. So much for political parties that are as a permanent way of dealing politically, to have all these parties. You know, this Hitler was totally against that. He hated all these parties vying and taking turns and, you know, in the arguing in the parliament, never getting anything done. And when things didn't get done, they never took responsibility. They blamed it on each other. They blamed it on the other party and so on. And nobody ever had to take responsibility. And that was one of his big themes that he, awarenesses that he came up with. That if there was one man who was an honest man and really had the nation's interest at heart, he would take responsibility for what happened. But the way it was with all these parties, nobody took responsibility, and we know that's true. So, you know, he was right about everything, I think. In the end, you know, I have not cannot find anything he wasn't right about. There are some things you might say, well, this is a matter of judgment, but it wasn't so clear. But he made a good judgment based on everything available. So, going on, Hitler. National Socialism is no doctrine of laziness, but rather a doctrine of struggle. No doctrine of happiness or chance, rather a doctrine of work, a doctrine of struggle, yes, and thus a doctrine of sacrifice. We behaved that way before the war. It has been no different this year, and it will stay the same in the future. Even if we perish, Germany must live. It's barely living. Even if fate defeats us individually, Germany must live. And if we must accept privation and sorrow, Germany must exist in spite of privation and sorrow. Nothing great, and this is in 1937 already, when things were really going pretty well, although he hadn't annexed Austria yet, and, you know, hadn't done the Czechoslovak thing. So it was before that. Nothing great in this world is given to people. Everything must be fought for bitterly. The rise of a people, too, does not simply happen. It, too, must be fought for. But the problem should not be merely a logical consequence of this tendency. We should not ask what we should do tomorrow or the next day. Rather, the leadership of the movement must look decades into the future. Immortal, ethical, imperishable ideas should also shine as brightly for people in distant centuries. If you believe that you must be free, then recognize that nothing will give you freedom but your own sword. My entire life, to the last breath, has one goal: to make Germany free, healthy, and happy once more. And I may have, I don't know if I cut some of this out, I don't think so, but then it goes on with this last paragraph in the same speech, where he's speaking on the struggle for the Reich. And he says, no power has the right or the strength to determine the path of a people that does not seek this and only this. And that is a strong Reich, a proud people, so large and so strong that each German once again can affirm, I am a German and I am proud to be so. Well, we hear the same simple ideas again and again. Now that's the end of that. Now here's a few more. This was spoken in 1939, April 28th, in the Reichstag as part of his response to Roosevelt. Roosevelt had said something. Since the day I began my political life, I have had but one goal: winning back the freedom of the German nation, building the strength and power of our Reich, overcoming the domestic fragmentation of our people, removing the barriers abroad, and ensuring its economic and political independence. Another quote from September 1st, 1939. This is the day that he gave his speech, that they had, the troops had gone into Poland. And he said, I have once again put on that uniform that is to me the holiest and most precious. I will take it off only after victory, or I will no longer live. As a National Socialist and German soldier, I begin this battle with a strong heart. My whole life has been nothing other than a battle for my people, for its resurrection, for Germany. This battle is an affirmation of faith in this people. I have never learned one word, that is capitulation. And, you know, he stuck with that to the end. As I already said, in the first hour, under lots of criticism, and still criticized today by all these people all over the internet, well, Hitler's mistake was... Of course, I have said that Hitler's biggest mistake was being a vegetarian, taking on a vegetarian diet, and not altering it for... You know, for health reasons, being so strict with it. But that's the way he was about everything once he made up his mind. So he certainly was not going to capitulate ever. And that's why he was so unhappy at the end there with Heinrich Himmler and Goring. What's Goring's first name? Oh, well. Because at the very end there, they decided that they had a better idea to save Germany. They're going to try to save Germany and try to talk to the Allies themselves, make some kind of arrangement. In Goring's case, he said he thought that, Hitler was down there in that bunker and he didn't really know what was going on and he wasn't going to do anything. And so Goring thought that, based on something Hitler had said in the past, years before, that, you know, he needed to take over. Well, both of them decided that they would do something different. But Hitler's thing was no capitulation. And, you know, as time passes, I do think he has been vindicated, because none of these efforts came to anything or would come to anything. And they just made the Germans look weaker. And you might as well fight to the end. That's what Hitler thought, fight to the end, because, you know, they're going to kill you anyway. They're going to kill you one way or the other. So you might as well die honorably. And I think he's right in that, because not everybody's going to die anyway, even if they do fight to the end, because there was. Well, when he did his suicide, he knew that that would be the end of the war and that they wouldn't be able to hold it back and they would have to. Well, he maybe hoped for things to happen, but, you know, the only thing that the Allies would allow was an unconditional surrender. They weren't going to talk to any Germans. They don't care Hitler dead, alive, or what, who they were. They weren't going to talk to any Germans. They had fought for the very prize that they won, which was total control. And that's with the Germans not having a thing to say about anything. So that's what they insisted on having. All right, another... Let me give the number in case anybody, you probably, if you're listening, you're on the website, so you know what the number is, but I'll just give it anyway. And I'm not insisting that somebody call just for no reason, but I'll just give it, 830-443-4911. All right. Hitler said in January 30th, 1942, I think this is the speech, after the, January 30th. I'm not sure if this is the speech after the United States declared war or not. But we will do whatever is in our strength to resist our enemies, he says. A spirit has arisen in this land that the world has never conquered. A faithful sense of community has seized our people. No people in the world will take from us what we gained after so long a detour of domestic strife, and that makes us so proud over against other peoples. In the age of Jewish capitalist rule by money, status, and class, the National Socialist People's State stands as an unshakable monument of social justice and clear reason. It will survive not only this war, but the coming millennium. Well, I think that's possible. I think it's possible that the ideas behind it are surviving. He finishes this little quote as, an empire will collapse. Mr. Churchill may believe it will be Germany, but I know that it will be England. But you know, this is really interesting, because while England defeated Germany and had a lot to say for a long time, today, which country is in total shambles and has collapsed? And that is England. Poor England. I mean, we have to have pity. We have to feel sorry. It's horrible to see the composition of the United Kingdom today, everywhere, but particularly in England. It's just so much. It's so black. It's not English. And Germany, in spite of being an occupied country, and having to obey what the United States tells it to do, and all of its politicians are approved by the Jews in the United States. It's one and the same thing. You know, they still hold on to some degree to being Germans, although bad things are happening there with all these Turks. There's nothing wrong with Turks, but, you know, they don't belong there. But they want to be there. Now this terror cell trial is coming up. I was reading about it last night. It's scheduled for the beginning of May. And it just sounds awful. It just sounds awful. Well, I'll talk about that on another occasion. So, in the same speech, January 30th, 1942, Hitler said, "If Providence preserves me, my pride will be to return to the great work of peace that I still intend. But because I believe that Providence wants this battle to be fought according to its mysterious will, I ask only that Providence entrust me with the burden of this struggle. I want to carry it and will not shy from any responsibility. I want to accept it any time what comes. I want to carry any responsibility as I have carried it in the past. Today, I feel myself to be only the first musketeer of the Reich." I thought that was quite good. In 42, for some reason, I should get the whole speech to find out where it's from, but, you know, where he gave it. But he's saying that, no, he's talking about Providence again and saying that he is doing what he thinks Providence wants to be done, that Providence wants this battle to be fought, and it's according to its own mysterious will. And he's asking only that he be entrusted with the burden of the struggle. He'd be entrusted to carry out the struggle. He wants to do it. I think he knows he's the only one who could do it in the way that he thinks it should be done. I'm sure he felt that way. And he knew that the German people looked to him as their leader, and you had to have the backing of the German people in that way. He was very aware of that he had won over the German people totally, and that they looked to him and loved him and wanted him to be doing what he was doing, and they supported him. And if you had a change of leadership, you know, then you'd have these battles and people would be divided. So he knew that this was the way it should be, and that he had to carry it on. He had to continue. He couldn't weaken, you know, because he was the only one who could do it at this point. And he says, when he said he was the first musketeer of the Reich, I was going to look that up. I'm not sure. That must be an allusion to the three musketeers, you think? What, how would that fit? If anybody knows the answer to that, feel free to call in if you know what he would mean here by being the first musketeer. Now, the first musketeers, well, they're shooting these muskets, aren't they? I'm not clear. I never did like that. I saw that movie, The Three Musketeers. I think it was back in the 1950s. And I was too young. I didn't really understand it. And I still don't understand it today because I'm never interested in it. I don't particularly care for things like that. All right. Now I have something from the last lines from Hitler's last will and testament, which are something to be remembered, I think. And this was his last words in his last testament that were uttered on the 29th of April in 1945 in the bunker, signed by him and signed by four witnesses: Goebbels, Wilhelm Burgdorf, one of his aides, Martin Bormann, we know he's his secretary, and Hans Krebs, who was, I should know who he is, but I can't think right now, but he was there too. And Hitler ended up by saying, "Above all, I charge the leadership of the nation and their followers with the strict observance of the racial laws and with merciless resistance against the universal poisoners of all peoples, international Jewry." Now, I think this is important to remember because we have so many people now who are saying that Hitler, in the last years and so on, changed his views about race, and he wasn't so strict about race at all. And, you know, he admired he admired Islam. He had good relations with the Arabs and some Arabs. And of course, then there was also Japan and all of this. And he really was, there were good relations and there was even exchanges between Germany and Japan. None of that means that he changed his mind about race and race mixing and interracial laws and people and other races coming to live in Germany or, associating in that way. It was all about diplomatic relations. And he had an admiration for certain other nations. They didn't have to be white. You could admire a lot of things about them, but he didn't want them to mix together with Germans. He wanted Germans to be Germans. And in spite of the flaws, of the failings in Germans, he knew very well what German failings were. And he knew it was this tolerance and this, thinking too much of the other party and, wanting to give away too much and so on. But he still knew that, he believed in race and in pure races. And that's absolutely, you can find that everywhere in everything that he did and said. And those people who are trying to say, and I'll even say, like, a very, very good person, who wrote that book, Black Nazis. That was not accurate. There were no black Nazis. Those were some mascots or something, down there in North Africa that they found. There was a few of them, and then they did probably give some guns and uniforms to some black troops. More as a kind of they didn't expect that they were going to accomplish much except to just say, well, we're on Germany's side or something, but this does not mean, this is ridiculous to talk like this. And so, he's charging the leadership after he's gone, because he had already decided what to do, with strict observance of the racial laws. What were the racial laws? The Nuremberg laws and all other racial laws that they had enacted in Germany. That's what he's referring to. And to resist always the universal poisoners of all people, international Jewry. So, all right, I have only about 20 minutes left, and I've got this good material from Horst Mahler. Let's see if I have. Oh, I wanted to talk for a minute about Hitler and his generals. He was saying here, when he was talking about, where would it be? Where was it that he was talking about, never weakening, and holding your strength and, together and, not caving in. I can't find the exact words, but anyway, he had a time. Often it's been said, another of these detractors, they say, that Hitler should have listened to his generals. He didn't listen to his generals enough. His generals knew what they were doing. And blah, blah, blah. And they also, here's the thing I really wanted to say. They also want to give credit to the generals for the victories and not to Hitler. Well, I think all generals and all troops and all of that who do, a great job that they so often did, deserve a lot of credit. But the designer of so many of these battles was Adolf Hitler. And they, again, the enemies, I think, who don't like that, who want to portray Hitler as somebody who was in over his head. He was he wasn't bright enough. He was, he didn't have any education. He didn't have any real military training. He didn't have anything, and therefore he screwed up. Not so. He put in so much time and study before making plans for some of these battles. And the ones that turned out brilliantly successful were his doing. And often when they didn't, it was because he couldn't get the generals to do what he wanted, or there were some traitorous stuff going on in there, on both fronts. But I know that he made it clear, and I get this in Ayn Rand or Hitler by Hermann Giesler, that Wilhelm Crispin and I, Wilhelm Crispin translated, and I helped him with it, and we got all these parts from it published. But there are a lot of situations that were talked about in there that made it clear that Hitler was had to use all of his powers of will and persuasion and this great personality that he had and this brilliant mind and so on. He had to use all of that when he was in these meetings with his generals. These what were called, God, I use that word enough, how could I forget it? What were called, or is the German word for it? But, you know, they'd have these map meetings 2 or 3 times a day sometimes. And all his top ones who he coordinated with, you know, would attend. I mean, he was out there in the field in his, camps that were Fuhrer camps that were put up close to where the fighting was going on and so on. And the generals would argue with him or wouldn't want to do what he wanted. And he did not order them. He did not say, well, you do this or your head's coming off or I'll put someone else in your place. He never did that. He didn't want people to do things. He didn't want anybody, any Germans to be doing things under some force that they disagreed with. He wanted to win them over. He wanted them to agree with him so that when they did it, they had their heart in it and they believed in it. And they, at least they weren't opposed to it. So, you know, that's very, very important. And I don't know how to compare him to Stalin here. I don't know what Stalin, what kind of relationship Stalin had with his generals, because they generally seem to be doing their best, but they weren't always maybe as effective. But Hitler's generals were going by the military ideas that they had learned, you know, how to conduct these things and what to do and why. And Hitler had other ideas sometimes. He had a more brilliant idea, and he saw further ahead. And he was knew that, for one thing, a lot of these battles, you might win a battle, but you weren't going to gain that much. And he knew that they needed to gain resources, particularly oil. And they needed to put out areas where the enemy was being able to use these resources and take them over so they would have these resources. And all of this was a part of his planning, particularly on the Eastern Front. And there were times when his generals were opposed to it because they wanted to use the traditional idea, like conquering Moscow. You know, part of that Eastern Front had to do with Moscow. Hitler wanted Moscow to come last, and they wanted Moscow to come first, as far as, you know, winning the battle there. And he talked to Giesler about how he had to use all of his energy. And sometimes it just left him worn out to convince these generals. And he did it in the way of wanting to convince them. And when they left, his personality was so powerful. His mind, his reasoning, his thought, his logic and so on was so compelling that they did leave. Totally convinced and totally on his side and in agreement. But like so often happens, this happens a lot with all of us, you're persuaded by the superior mind. Then when you're away from it for a day or two, you start falling back into your old way of thinking in your own arguments. You start doubting that and then you're not as convinced anymore. And then you don't always do it, like you were supposed to, or maybe you have to be convinced all over again. I mean, this was a lot of work that Hitler had to do. So his job was very, very exhausting. Not only did it go on 24 hours a day for several years, but I mean, he wanted the people around him, including the generals and everybody else, the political leaders too, to do the right thing. As he saw it, but from their own free will. So this is something, you know, that when it came to his that brilliant victory over France on the Western Front in 1940, that brilliant plan that is so many people want to say that Manstein was the designer of that plant. And some people want to say that, oh, I should have opened that story up so I can remember it. That another, who was that bad general that he had trouble with, that he did finally let go? He did finally fire this guy. His name is so simple. I can't think of it. It's a short name. Anyway, he's one of the most famous of the Third Reich generals. Well, he wants credit for it too. Although he was the one who was trying to block it and trying to hide it and didn't allow it to be passed on. But the thing is that Manstein did have the same idea that Hitler did, not to do the old Schlieffen plan, but to do this thing going up around from the north and come down, take them all by surprise and so on. Well, Hitler worked it out in absolute detail. And he had gotten then, after he had done this, he had gotten a plan, finally, that had been held up. It's true, it had been held up. It had not. That was this general, I can't think of his name, who didn't allow this plan for Manstein to get to Hitler. But when it finally did get to Hitler, oh, I know, Manstein had a meeting with Hitler, and that's when it came out. And Hitler was, that he had that same idea and found out that Hitler never received his plan. So people now want to say, oh, that's Manstein's plan. But Hitler, they came up with it separately, but Hitler had it more worked out. He had, of course, a lot of aides there, and they worked out. He spent a long time with real 3D map type things with troops and divisions and, moving things around and showing how it all worked out. And it involved these glider flights to the, poor memory, to that big barrier that was, that they depended on so much that, all right, I've got some popping up on my screen here. So, but anyway, this was a brilliant, brilliant plan. Adolf Hitler was the author of it. He did design it. It did work wonderfully. And after that, people had changed their opinion of him a lot, and they had a lot of faith in him. And he got a lot of mileage out of that, which he should have. But then again, the detractors start trying to blame every defeat on Hitler because he was interfering. He wasn't interfering. He had the better ideas, and he had to try to get his generals, who sometimes were not as brilliant as he was, to accept what he wanted. And sometimes as the war went on and things and of course, a big problem was they had so many losses, so many casualties of men. And these generals, no leaders of men want to put their men in such a terrible situation, where knowing that there's going to be high losses. But Hitler was looking at it in many cases from that was the only thing that they could do. And so he saw the German people and these German soldiers as being willing to sacrifice. I think that's true. I'm not an expert on all this, but people say, oh, well, you know, if you're at war, you're going to sacrifice lives. And you're going to lose, a lot of people are going to lose their life in every battle. And in some battles, probably more are going to lose their life. But, you're trying to win. You're trying to win. So, there was an awful lot of life lost on D-Day, on the Allied side. But they figured it was worth it. And they didn't have any better plan. And they did succeed. So now it's a big success, but they lost an awful lot of American and other Canadian and other lives by the way they did that. So I just wanted to say that. I mean, I'm not going to shut people up about it, but these are whole areas of research that people should go in with a more unbiased point of view and try to get all the information in the facts down rather than just pushing out all these opinions based on nothing. Well, now I've used up most of my time. Nobody's called in. I will check the mail one more time. Probably nothing here. That's okay because I want to talk a little bit about, I have a lot of listeners. I'll say that. So people must be enjoying it. I want to end with a little bit about Horst Mahler. Is that, now I've got a little more current news. Maybe I'll give that and save the other for another time. You know, just something I noticed. Yeah, looking up news about Hitler's birthday. It's that there's a story in April 15th, just, you know, 5 days ago, which was titled Russian Neo-Nazis Celebrate Hitler's Birthday, Part 1, Background. And they're going to have a Part 2 after the birthday's over to see what they have to say about it, what happened in Russia. But, you know, this is some kind of a website. I quoted it before, Jamestown something. And it's kind of a Middle East and Russian news or something. But I don't, the point of view of the people who run it is, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's certainly not pro Hitler or pro National Socialists or anything like that. So, but they say, you know, they're talking about that how there's these neo Nazis in Russia, and they always come out and do things when it's time to commemorate Hitler's birthday on April 20th, and they're looking to see what they're up to right now. Starting, this was on the 15th, and they say that they always celebrate Hitler's birthday, these Russian neo-Nazis, with a large number of attacks against members of ethnic minorities. And, you know, that's just terrible that they should do that, of course, is their opinion. And they're going to look at Russia's extreme rights, annual attacks on minorities in this part one. And they say that the level of Russian neo-Nazi attacks coincides with that coincide with Hitler's birthday have become so serious in recent years. This must be Jews writing this. That starting in 2002, the Russian authorities in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Novgorod started advising racially different students not to leave their dormitories on April 20th. And that in the last few years, there have been troubling attacks. And now here's what they came up with. In 2009, neo-Nazis murdered a Tajik man and an Uzbek man in Moscow and attacked Caucasian men, who knows what that means, called them names or something, in Stavropol, and assaulted anti-fascists in St. Petersburg. This comes from the Bigotry Monitor. And so, you know, naturally, if there's anti-fascists, maybe they're having a demonstration, and maybe the anti-fascists started assaulting them, so they assaulted them back. That's usually the way these things are. And they write it up in this way, trying to make out like this is a real problem. In a huge country like Russia, you know, how big is Russia anyway? Bigger than anybody else. I think it's bigger than anything else. And there, you've got, two men are murdered and who knows under what circumstances. And a few men, and a few others are having, you know, assaulted or something. But they survived. So that's all they came up with that was of any value, you know, in that whole article that I read. But they use these headlines, Russian neo-Nazis celebrate Hitler's birthday. And, you know, they've got some people with their fists up in the air in a picture. Now, another story that I can end up with here is right-wing groups to hold summit in Munich on Hitler's birthday. This is this year. And this was in the Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany, which is a kind of a left-wing paper, center to left. That's pretty left. And I got this at World Crunch, which is a good place for getting news that you don't find anywhere else. And it says this is from Munich, and it says that this Saturday, April 20th, a group of right-wing fraternities in Germany will hold what they are calling a regional conference in Munich. They say the extreme right-wing Danubia fraternity has also been invited to attend. Well, we know there are these fraternities, and they are right-wing fraternities in Germany and in Austria. They are old. They go back a long way. They have a lot of history to them. And they're nationalist-type groups, and they're young fellows. And I don't know if they are associated with colleges and universities or if they're kind of separate from that now, but there are fraternities, they have names and so on, and people join and they have different different things that they do, but they're not, they've never done any damage to anyone. You know, I mean, they're just politically nationalists. They don't go around hurting anybody. But here it turned out that this, this meeting of one of these universities, one of these fraternities, the, umbrella organization of the German fraternities, has, was going to have a conference, and there's planning a conference in Munich, and it turned out they set it on April 20th. Now, they say that that was, they didn't intend to be connected with Hitler's birthday, and, you know, a lot of people aren't so aware of that. I mean, I don't know if they did or they didn't, but the whole, you know, everybody goes up in arms because they're going to have this meeting on April 20th for this fraternity. So I don't know if I've lost track of this, if they, if we're still going to have it. Let's see, there's too much here. Following, somebody, in one of these conferences 1 year ago in the Danubia fraternity, they said that in their newspaper that a speaker at their conference had complained that Nazi history, women, foreigners, and the Vaterland had become taboo subjects in Germany, and stated that resisting this dictatorship of speech was a duty. Now, you know, in Germany, what's so horrible is that if you even talk like that, if you say you want free speech, if you say anything like that, you're just a right-wing extremist, and you need to be monitored, and in fact, your whole organization should be banned. And with this trial that's coming up of this woman, Beate Schappe, coming up in May, they're going to attempt to close down everything right wing in Germany. It's something to be watched. I'll be looking at it. So, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy the rest of this birthday of Adolf Hitler, and some of you, it's nighttime already. So thank you for listening. I'll see you again next week.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.